De Colores. It was the song of the workers, the United Farm Workers. That was their song. So it's a tribute to spring and to farmers and to the good earth that sustains us all. This is Chris. It's a Peace and Justice show. I traded off this Friday with my colleague Corey Hunt so he could have a little more time to prepare for next week. We're hoping we can have a special guest for you then. And I'm just catching my breath. My guest wasn't answering the phone, so I will be putting on another song right now and then getting back to you. We have rotating hosts here on the Peace and Justice Show. We're with you every Friday, and from 11:30 to 1, I have a really special show today, I believe, because of the crisis we're in here in Chico. But we're going to start off a little bit with the big picture, if I can get Joanne Sheehan from the War Resisters League on the phone with me. And so I'm going to proceed to get back to that endeavor. And here's a short but beautiful song from a Chico local, Karen Anderson. Here you go.
My hands, I give them over. Make my heart an open door. Make my life a house of spirit. Make me an instrument, nothing more. Take my hands, I give them over. Make my heart an open door. Make my life a house of spirit. Make me an instrument, nothing more. Take my hands, I give them. Make my heart an open door. Make my life a house of spirit. Make me an instrument, nothing more. Make me an instrument, nothing more. Make me an instrument, nothing more.
All right, so that may seem a little hippy-dippy to you, but, you know, it's the way I felt yesterday when I was walking back and forth and back and forth with the belongings of unhoused people. There's no room for judgment. There's no room for anything other than service at certain points in your life. And so I have a wonderful woman I want to bring to you. She's trying to make it to her car after an appointment. And her name is Joanne Sheehan. She has been an organizer, nonviolence trainer, and educator for over 50 years, much of that with the War Resisters League. She's been on the staff of the War Resisters League in the New England Regional Office based in Norwich, Connecticut since co-founding it in 1985. Active with War Resisters International since 1983, she served as a chair from 1998 to 2006 and edited the Handbook on Nonviolent Campaigns. And she is a Resistance Studies Fellow. Joanne has been the chair of the Voluntown Peace Trust since 2012 and is active in the Community Land Trust movement. And regarding War Resisters League, the War Resisters League community has found affinity not through race, class, or religion. This is for 97 years, going on 98 years, but through the collective desire to live in a world free from the violence of war and oppression. From refusing to participate in civil defense drills as early as 1955 to providing educational resources that counter the anti-immigrant and Islamophobic rhetoric of today, War Resisters League has been organizing against the racist, sexist, and exploitative systems that promote cultures of fear and ultimately root war for over 95 years. And let me see if she's there.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Joanne.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
I'm good. Hey, I first got hold of you because you had written an article that I thought was really important. I actually done two important things in the last 2 months that really piqued my interest. But there's an article. It's called "The Roots of Nonviolent Action in the U.S. Are in the Black Community," and that came out during Black History Month. And I wanted to, if you could, this will help us understand a little bit about the history of War Resisters League as mm-hmm. well as nonviolence in America and the importance of the struggle that has been so long in coming against racism in the United States. Can you tell that story, Joanne Sheehan?
Sure, I can. Yeah, and thanks for having me, and thanks for noticing that article. I wrote that because as a nonviolence trainer and a proponent of nonviolent action, I so often hear, well, you know, nonviolence is for people in the white community. It's not for people who can take risks, right? And any of us who really understand nonviolent action know that primarily it was organized and kind of became really a strategic tool, if you will, by Gandhi and in the Indian independence movement. And that in the United States, while there have been a lot of individual acts of nonviolence, we're really talking about kind of a systematic kind of campaign with goals, with multiple tactics being used and prepared, you know, and people preparing for that as a group, right? And so what was happening was this, that African Americans in this country were clearly beginning, even as early as the 20s and 30s, to look towards ways of ending segregation, working for equality, getting rid of Jim Crow. And so they became increasingly fascinated, particularly in the 1930s and by the late 30s, at what was happening in India as that campaign was getting more international notice. And because as you said, War Resisters League is 97 years old. You know, there are already networks that came out after World War I of folks who were paying attention to what was happening in other parts of the world, including in India. And so increasingly folks were paying attention to what was happening and wanting to bring that to the United States. And Howard Thurman, a great black theologian, went to India, actually not to meet with Gandhi. He went because the Christian community there, which there is a one on the, particularly on the West Coast, invited him to come and speak. So he and his wife were part of a team of four people who went and traveled around India and then did meet Gandhi at the end. And it's interesting that Gandhi kind of said, you know, it may be you, Negroes, of course, as they were called back then, you know, it may be you who really take nonviolence and bring it to the world. And in some ways, Gandhi was right, because I think that there was so much belief at that point in time that nonviolence was so based in the culture of India that it couldn't be taken out of that context. And so what happened was is that in 1940, a group of people, some of whom were white clergy, who had been in India and kicked out of India, Methodist missionaries who had been kicked out of India because they supported the independence movement. So they were kicked out by the British colonial power. And when they came back to the United States, began to work more with the black community and formed what was called the Harlem Ashram. There's very little written about this. But I found lots of discussions about it and stories about it in various in books about by various people who had spent time there, particularly James Farmer, who should be mentioned because he was one of the key people who started the Congress of Racial Equality. So what you see here is this group of people coming together that we don't know a lot about, but we know about what they produced. And so the Congress of Racial Equality grew out of that, fired Rustin, one of WRL's and Fellowship of Reconciliation activists, somebody who helped start Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He lived around the corner from it. There were a number of people who got together. And also Krishnalal Sridharani, who had been an Indian involved in the Salt March, did his PhD on that, and wrote a book called Winning Without War, which became kind of the book that they used to be their handbook, and the book that they used that helped translate by an Indian who lived in both continents, the strategic elements of nonviolence into a way that then could be used and developed by the civil rights movement. So those are really the roots. Go back to the roots are deep. But I looked at in this article really 1940 in the Harlem Ashram is then giving rise to these other organizations which we're more familiar with, like Congress of Racial Equality. Although I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that some of their earlier activities were in the 1940s. Marjorie Swan, who helped start the Community for Nonviolent Action, which is now the Voluntown Peace Trust, was a charter member of CORE and got her nonviolence training in 1942. So then you saw people like Wally Nelson, who later was known as one of the founders of the later day war tax assistance movement. Later day meaning 1948, not back to Thoreau's time. He was one of the early nonviolence trainers of Congress of Racial Equality. And then there was this break because there was this war, right? World War II. Although a lot of the men in particular at that time were also conscientious objectors, the black men and the white men who were involved in these movements. And so Byard Rustin, Wally Nelson, those folks all ended up in jail, in prison for refusing to go into World War II, but then came out of prison and, the Journey of Reconciliation, which some people may be aware of as really the first Freedom Rides, was organized by Byard Rustin, a black man, George Hauser, a white man, both who are war resisters, and both who had been kind of part of this Harlem Ashram gathering of folks exploring the development of nonviolent action, and then did a two-day training in preparation for eight black men and eight white men. No women. They thought it was too dangerous at the time to go through a trip on interstate buses because the Supreme Court had already decided that they should be integrated. However, the local states were not allowing that, and so they really challenged that through that action, which gave rise later to the Freedom Rides. I think people who know that history of the civil rights movement know of that. And that, interestingly, was not only included women, but was led by Diane Nash, who was one of the people who was trained by James Lawson in Nashville. So I think that looking at this history and looking at kind of, the sit-ins, which we're more familiar with, which started in 1960, again, James Lawson had been a minister in India and was paying attention to both the Indian movement, what was happening, but also it was getting word as to what was happening in the United States and with the Montgomery bus boycott, which was 55, and the like. So I think that deep, we have so much to be thankful for those people. And I think the other thing to say is that while it was clearly black leadership, and while the white folks who, like the ministers who helped start Harlem Ashram, you know, really acted in as real allies, as real accomplices in all of this, and really were, you know, made that kind of really important space to for the black leadership to develop. And to develop the strategies and the use of nonviolent action as they saw appropriate in the campaigns that they were developing to end segregation and fight the inequality.
So this is Chris. It's the Peace and Justice Show. I'm talking with Joanne Sheehan, who is an author, as well as coordinating at the War Resisters League, one of the oldest peace groups in the United States. The article is "The Roots of Revolutionary Nonviolence in the United States Are in the Black Community." I would suggest that people read this article in order to really understand better some of the roots of nonviolence and the struggle for equality in this country. I wanted to ask you, we won't have much time, but I want to ask you just a little bit about a woman who's been lost. So many, you know, I wanted to do something during Women's History Month, but just as briefly as you can, I wanted to ask you about the late writer and activist Barbara Deming. She wrote about the two hands of nonviolence in her book-length essay called Revolution in Equilibrium, and I want to read this quote. "With one hand, we say to one who is angry or to an oppressor or to an unjust system, stop what you are doing. I refuse to honor the role you are choosing to play. I refuse to obey you. I refuse to cooperate with your demands. I refuse to build the walls and the bombs. I refuse to pay for the guns. With this hand, I will even interfere with the wrong you are doing. I want to disrupt the easy pattern of your life." But then the advocate of nonviolence raises the other hand. It is raised outstretched, maybe with love and sympathy, maybe not, but always outstretched. With this hand, we say, I won't let go of you or cast you out of the human race. I have faith that you can make a better choice than you are making now. And I'll be here when you are ready. Like it or not, we are a part of one another. And right now, Joanne Sheehan, we could use some wisdom because we are in a terrible time in our community, and even people within within organizing are at one another, but especially we have a lot of opposition, a lot of hate groups, and I was wondering if you could talk about Barbara Deming's work a little bit, because she really confronted the personal part of nonviolence.
She did, and she, you're right, that Barbara is another one of those kind of hidden figures, hidden people who did so much writing. I think that she's most known in the feminist community because of the work that she did after she wrote Revolution and Equilibrium. She began to really explore more the connection between nonviolence and feminism and wrote a lot more about that. On Anger was one of her first printed as an essay, but it was actually a speech that she was to give at a War Resisters League national conference. And she was in a terrible car accident on the way down and survived it, but was quite unable for a while to be as active as she had been before. So it was read and then published by Liberation Magazine. And that was kind of the beginning of a lot of her writings, particularly during the 70s. And then for people who went to the Seneca Women's Encampment in the 80s. She went up there and was joined with that group as well. But, you know, she arrived here near where I live. I'm in Norwich and just upriver from New London, Connecticut, where the submarines are built. And she came here to cover a nonviolence training in 1960 that was organized by a number of the people who I mentioned who had been earlier activists, white and black activists, with the Community for Nonviolent Action. And she says in her article about it, she said, "I didn't think I'd be impressed by them because I'd never heard of them before." But she stayed for a 16-day training. 16 days. Oh, I haven't done that kind of training in a long time. And it really turned her into a very committed nonviolent activist. So while she was a writer, and she had been a writer before this, she also became an activist. And I think the thing, when you ask Chris about kind of the connection of what we're doing now and how we're facing, you know, what we're facing now, she became part of two peace walks through the South that were extremely confrontational in terms of not the peace walks confrontational, but the white racist in the South being confrontational about black and white people walking together, about being together, about calling for justice together. And particularly in Albany, Georgia, when they were stopped and refused to go through town, many of the people did two jail sentences of 25 days each and were fasting while in jail and were really brutally treated, and eventually walked out of town together as black and white folks, the very thing that they had spent 2 months campaigning for there. And I think I tell that story because I think sometimes I hear people say, it's never been this bad. Well, yes, it's been this bad and worse. I think that we can take courage in the words of Barbara and in the actions of Barbara as we look at, how do we, and as you said, very personal kind of a way. I mean, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, wherever, I live in Connecticut, but I live in Eastern Connecticut, and there is a lot of racism here, and there are communities that are primarily white and don't want, including Voluntown, where we have our peace trust, where they don't like it that we bring integrated groups of people in, that we bring black kids from the north end of Harvard in for camp in the summer and the like, and are still challenged about that now. And so how do we continue to try to, kind of keep doing that work, keep relating to those people in a way, standing up and saying, no, we are going to continue to do this, but not tearing them down, respecting their humanity, even when they disrespect humanity, because that is where we see that ability for transformation and for change.
Let me stop you there. We absolutely have to talk about the War Resisters League just a little bit. For years, we have used your tax pie every single tax day, your pie chart. Whenever we've done work at the high school about conscription and recruitment in the schools, we've used your literature, and we've got 2 minutes left. Please talk about what the situation is with War Resisters League and how people can find out more about it and maybe assist you if it's needed.
Sure. So it's warresisters.org, and the new pie chart is out where your tax dollars go. And so people can both download them online, but also order them. We've got people going into the office and doing orders. Remember, May 17th now, or is it the 18th? Is the new April 15th this year? Is tax day, and we have a lot. We are one of the organizations that produces a lot of kind of recruitment material. People can go online. Again, most of that you can see and download, but you can also order it. Kind of having that consistency of helping people understand kind of, that the recruiters are out there to recruit. They're out there not to tell you the truth about what happens in the military, but to try to get their quota. And we're there to kind of uncover the lies and to be clear about what the realities are of war and of being in the military. And so there's also, there's emails there, there's ways to be in touch. While people are not able to work regularly in the office, we're all working remotely and continuing to respond to the requests for the resources that we develop and provide.
And lastly, I think that the email is warresisters.org. On there's a lot of different campaigns that you're involved in. Is there anyone that you would point people to at this time?
Well, I think that looking at, particularly looking at where your tax dollars go right now, it's been harder to be out there, except for after George Floyd and with the uprising when we were out in the streets. I think that I've been doing a lot of writing in order for people to kind of, sometimes it's important for us to go inward to kind of do that preparation, do that training, understand that we need to get back out there as it's is it safe and safer to get back out there and do the kinds of organizing that we need to do? We do need to pay attention, and WRL is doing this, that Congress may at some point in the near future add women to the requirement of registering for Selective Service when they're 18, and that's certainly a campaign and a fight that we will engage in. Not to say women shouldn't, but to say no one should have to sign up for an archaic system that doesn't exist except to say we have control of you.
Right. I want to thank you for all your work. I had so many years and so many campaigns. I wrote down all your different campaigns on a piece of paper. It stretches very long, since 1923, when War Resisters League was founded, up until the current time, and a lot of shifting and growing and movement. And it's a great history, and I wish we had more time for some of it, because it really is the history of resistance in America.
It really is. And as we look forward to our 100th coming up, then we will be, we're looking at different ways of recording that history, because that really helps us move forward. It's not about moving back. It's about kind of remembering the steps we've made, the things we've done, how to build on it. Nonviolence is an exploration, one that has just begun, Barbara Deming said. And I think that's important to remember, that it's not just begun at this point, but it is one where we, we have this power, but we have to develop it, we have to understand it, we have to build community around it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Joanne Sheehan, for being on the Peace and Justice Show today. Stay well, and thank you for all the good work you've done.
Thank you. Have us back again. Have us back again.
Will do. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, so this is the Peace and Justice Show here on your community radio station, KZFR, and this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. It's not quite 12 yet. I want to thank some underwriters here. I'd like to thank first Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op, open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. And also Chico Velo, supporting bicycling education and advocacy since 1980. The Wildflower returns this year on April 24th with a slightly different twist, a two-week-long extravaganza with three options to participate, special edition merchandise, and virtual interaction along the way. To join this Wildflower adventure, visit wildflowercentury.org and on Facebook. And I'd like to thank Farmstar Pizza, seasonal and organic local offerings where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts. They have vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open 7 days a week or for to-go lunch and dinner orders. Find Farmstar Pizza at 2359 Esplanade at farmstarpizza.com or on Facebook. Their telephone number is 343-2056. And also Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. Seems like that 1980 keeps coming up, doesn't it? It was a big year. All right, so now it is noon coming up, and I'm going to get our next guest on the line. We're going to be talking homelessness for the next hour, and it's a very important topic. And let's have a little music here. This is, Tom Smith, Planting in a Drought is the name of the CD.
The money flows up. The money flows up. We're working in a world that's bottom side top, where the costs flow down, the money flows up. I work two jobs, my wife does too. There's nothing left when the bills come due. We can work all day, never fill our cup, where the costs flow down, the money flows up, money flows up, money flows up. We can work all day, never fill our cup, where the costs flow down, the money flows up. When you build your house on a master plan that's born on the backs of the common man, but the benefits go to the few at the top, then all the costs flow down and the money flows up, money flows up. You know, the money flows up. When the benefits go to the few at the top, then the costs flow down, the money flows up. I've got this to say to the penthouse.
All right. The money does seem to flow up, and it does not seem to flow back down into our communities in the ways that we need it. And my next guest is going to be talking some about that. Her name is Kelly Johnson, and she is an incredible attorney. She says about herself, Kelly Johnson is an attorney who is preparing to sue the city of Chico and the Chico police for violating the constitutional rights of Chico's unhoused residents. She is currently representing over 80 clients pro bono and has been assisting the unhoused move during the inhumane sweeps. On her Facebook page, she also says she's an environmental attorney, a bass player, a comedian, and a fierce activist. And thank you, Kelly Johnson, for being one of the greatest friends to the unhoused I have ever witnessed. Thank you so much for your work. I could tell many stories about seeing you in the trenches, but I'd like you to speak for yourself and start off by telling us a little bit about how you got involved with Chico's Unhoused.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. And, you know, I also want to give a shout out to you because I've seen you out there in the trenches and have been just completely shocked at the things that you've been able to do for people. And it's really great to have people like you who are out there who are doing the real work, you know, helping people during some of their darkest moments. But yeah, so you asked how I got into all of this. Well, really, it was from a message back during the holidays. It was around Christmas time. One of the local advocates messaged me, and they were actually talking about the angle with like the tribe and violating the memorandum of understanding that they have with the Machuca tribe, the city, and conducting their sweeps, and they didn't ask for permission. So I was asked this question from a legal standpoint. Someone asked if I would be interested in looking into it. And, you know, I kind of enjoyed the holidays and took some time for myself. And then after the holidays, I started really looking into it, and I just kind of saw what was happening here. And it just was so upsetting to me, the extent of the inhumanity that's happening. And ever since then, I've kind of just, I kind of stuck my foot in. And then next thing I know it, I was, you know, deep in the ocean of this issue, and I kind of have been immersed in it ever since.
Okay, maybe we should tell our listeners who don't know, since we have listeners all over the whole Sacramento Valley here in the north. In Chico Town, there have been relentless sweeps or evictions of unhoused people, and historically, this goes back from before the campfire, but our numbers just ballooned after the campfire, and there's probably, I don't know, 1,000 people unhoused living in camps, and it got, many of the people got comfortable during COVID because there was a shelter in place order, and so people had established lives, they've accumulated things, they've got neighbors, they've got community, and at the same time, a right-wing city council got in on concerns about garbage and drug abuse and other feigned issues rather than, you know, providing services. So I don't know in a nutshell if that's good enough, Kelly, but you can go further with that if you want to tell people about what the situation is.
Yeah, I mean, I've really never seen anything like it. They're coming out to parks and other places, just really anywhere where homeless people have set up camps. They're coming in with bulldozers. They'll frequently come in with you know, a dozen police officers were there when they evicted the Triangle. Well over a dozen city workers. They come in, they go up to people's tents regardless of if they're elderly or have physical and mental disabilities. They don't care about any of that, and they yell at the tent like, you have to leave in 5 minutes or 15 minutes, or you know, they have all the bulldozers, and if people don't want to leave, then they say, well, if you don't leave, we're going to arrest you. So essentially people, they don't want to lose all their stuff. There's bulldozers right there dumping tents left and right. You know, and I've seen people who were in the hospital when they got the notice that they had to move their stuff. They were in the hospital when the sweeps happened, and then I see them on the streets after, and they're just, this was back in the, during the really brutal winter right before the storms, and they some of these people, they were like, yeah, I've seen so many people around who didn't have tents because their tents were taken from one location or another, and it's happening everywhere. There's no place where homeless people in Chico are safe to be in the streets at this point in time.
Right, and we only have one large camp left, which is on Comanche Creek, and if and when that shoe drops, it is just going to be brutal, absolutely brutal. So, go ahead.
And that'll be any day, yeah, unfortunately. The Comanches, though, they just they're in the middle of, I suppose, a sweep of one of the two large encampments, and they got most of the people moved from Wind Chimes, which is one of the large encampments. Comanche is much larger, so when they move on Comanche, which they've been gesturing towards doing, so it'll be really any day now. I mean, it'll be completely a disaster.
Yeah. And maybe our listeners don't know what a disaster means, but it's not going to just be a disaster for the unhoused. It'll be a disaster for our community, because the unhoused have bodies and they have to be somewhere in those bodies. They have to go to the bathroom. They have to eat. You know, they exist. They are real, and they have lives, and they are many, many, many of them are such good people. And anyway, Kelly Johnson, I want to ask you, because this is what everyone wants to know. Why haven't the Legal Services of Northern California, the ACLU, or others done something to stop this? Because this is still COVID times. We're increasing the risk of this virus sweeping through these people. None of them are masked. You know, they cannot think about COVID right now. Why haven't we been able to stop this?
Well, you know, I can't speak for Legal Services or ACLU. I'm really, really hoping that Legal Services will file and get their injunction. They've been, you know, saying that they were going to do that since the Triangle, which was back in January. Mm-hmm. I've been really hoping that the ACLU will hop on board, primarily because, you know, I've been involved in this since towards the end of January at the Triangle. Before that, I live in Sacramento. I was not really that aware. I'd heard some things about the Chico's treatment of homeless people, but yeah, so I mean, these kinds of cases, they're extremely complex. It's difficult because the clients typically don't have phones. Even if they have phones, a lot of them got taken during a sweep, or their chargers are gone, or they don't have a way to charge them, so it's hard to contact people. They're being moved from one place to another, and so these kinds of cases are normally conducted by teams of like 40 attorneys, and like large legal teams do these cases. So for me, you know, I'm working just myself pro bono. I have a full-time job. I'm taking a lot of my vacation. I'm spending all of my vacation. We're furloughed with the state, so we get two extra vacation days a month. So I accumulated quite a bit of vacation. But the problem is that, you know, I'm going out there moving people and, you know, bringing food to people or dealing with emergencies that arise, like getting necessary medical services and all of these things. So it's hard for me to be, and also dealing with an intense barrage of harassment from the homeless hate groups in town. So it's been really hard for me to, you know, have time to file lawsuits. So really, I just need help in order to be able to get the ball rolling, and hoping that ACLU will come and I can just hand them everything and serve as a witness, because I have a lot of knowledge of the sweeps. You know, I've been there, and I so it'd be nice if I could have some help by an organization that has the resources to be able to do this. Other than that, I'm definitely still gearing up, and I still plan to file my lawsuit. It just is, unfortunately, takes some time, especially with some delays that have been caused by the homeless hate groups harassing me.
Yeah. You represent 80 clients, and I see on many tents the I forget what it's called, but
personal property notice.
Yeah, personal property notice that they're not to take their tents, that they, you know, because it's such a problem, like you said, that people lose everything in these sweeps. The police do not keep this stuff in any kind of an evidence room, and they basically treat it like it's junk, garbage. And, you know, some of it is, but most of it are things that people rely on. It's sleeping bags and tents and clothes and personal items. And so of these 80 clients, what is being asked of you? What are you telling people? How can poor one person, I'm hearing you're just one person, how are you able to represent them?
Well, first I go out, I go out to where they're camped, and I try to talk to as many as possible. So that's one thing, is if you're trying to talk to as many people as possible, you have to keep it brief, because when I go to an encampment, I'm working against the light of day, you know, and so I have a limited amount of time. So what I'll do is I'll tell people, you know, for a long time, there were no shelters available. There's a 50 to 100 person waiting list to get into a motel to do the quarantine that was required before entering the shelter. So there were no shelters, no motel rooms available, so no shelter beds available at the Triangle, the Caper Acres eviction, the eviction of Bidwell at the underpass and beyond, and the small evictions that have taken place, the one at Depot Park, and all of the smaller evictions that have taken place until a couple weeks ago when the Corona tier went down. They stopped doing the motel program, so at that point there was about 45 beds that became available at Torres immediately. But unfortunately, one of the problems is that Torres only allows people to leave for 4 hours a day. So what the city of Chico is doing is they're forcing people out. They want to force people into the shelters. Well, I think the last point in time survey said 600, maybe it was more, I'd have to look at the number, 600 homeless people that were counted. Well, and you know, they have 45 available beds at Torres, and they're evicting that between wind chimes and the side of the highways, that was approximately 80 people. Their count that said 40, I think that was the police who did that count, inaccurate. So I had a camper who knows everybody, like, walked the camp and counted, and between the side of the highways and wind chimes, they just evicted 80 people with 45 beds. So now they're about to evict Comanche. So they're evicting hundreds of people with only 45 beds. Those beds, if you're going to go into Torres shelter, you can only leave for 4 hours a day. So that's saying that you're going to give up 5/6 of your freedom, 5/6 of your time. You only get 4 hours a day, 1/6 of your time to pursue life, enjoy your freedom for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So this is a violation of the fundamental tenets of the Constitution, trying to force people into shelters with the ultimate goal of running them out of town. You know, Sean Morgan said that on the air, that his goal is to make people so miserable that they leave town. And that is the concerted goal of the city council, city leadership, and these homeless hate groups who just, I mean, the amount of hatred towards homeless people in Chico, I've never seen anything like it. My clients, I have an elderly client who just had a stroke, and he gets rocks thrown at his tent every day. When he got evicted from the side highway just a couple days ago, I told Caltrans, I said, this man just had a stroke a couple days ago. He's elderly, like, you know, and he had not been making sense. Like, he was unable to move out of the tent. Well, they told him that he should just get an ambulance. And they were like, if he's in medical, you just get him an ambulance. Well, he had gone to the hospital just a couple days ago. But INLO discriminates against homeless people as well. So instead of treating him and figuring out that he had just had a stroke, I mean, his left side of his body was numb, they assumed that he was just on meth and sent him out and put him back on the streets. And he had to walk all the way from INLO back to his encampment. And it took it out of him. I mean, after that, he was non-functional. And so when Caltrans and the highway patrol showed up at the side of the highway, he was unable to get out of that bed, his tent. And so he got taken by an ambulance, And when he got to the hospital, they did the same thing. They just immediately released him, and now he has no, like, he doesn't have a tent that he can put anywhere. He's just, like, sitting in a park.
Yeah, yeah. I'm aware of that situation, and I know. It is just terrible. Let's talk about the haters a little bit here. I hate to call them the haters, but it's hard to find humanity in a Facebook post when the Facebook post is so ugly and cruel. And I know you've been the brunt of this, and that you're a very fierce and a fighter and very scrappy with these people, but maybe you can tell us just a little bit about what you've seen and experienced with these folks.
Yeah, well, so I've actually collected 600 pages of screenshots of intensely aggressive and often violent hatred that is posted just between the sites, mostly the site One Chico, also Chico First, and Citizens First. Say Chico is really bad too, but I didn't get any material from there. Just between, in the last 2 months, collecting the most hateful screenshots of primarily One Chico resulted in 600 pages. And these are people who are talking about using hornet spray against homeless people, showing up in a thousand armed forces to go to the park to force people out, saying the cops can't get us if we have the numbers. Talking about how they blare their horns out when they drive past the encampments and shout, get a job, and all these horrible things, calling them transients, rodents, saying they to go by their camps yelling so that they scatter like roaches. And I mean, just talking about planting cougars in the park to eat them. It's absurd, the things that they talk about. And so a lot of this hatred is directed not only at homeless people, but also at anyone who makes a name for themselves in the community as an activist for homeless people. And anyone who makes a name for themselves like that is subject to their intense barrage of bullying. And the goal is not only to make homeless people so miserable, to strip them of all of their property, their dignity, and to criminalize them and to force them out of town, then it is also their other goal at the same time is to troll and bully advocates for homeless people in order to intimidate them into silence. So the second that I posted the sign, I made it 3 personal property signs. I made them myself. They're handmade. They each took hours because I cut out each letter. And then on the back, it's a personal property of the people who currently reside here. Do not remove. And on the back, it had a legal letter talking about the Constitution and Martin for the City of Boise. And, you know, it provided my name and my phone number. And so after I posted that sign, I just got completely trolled, blasted. These people are trying to literally get me fired from my job, get me disbarred, so they're trying to take away my legal license. They tried to get me blacklisted from renting U-Hauls. They posted all of the numbers of all of the U-Hauls. They found out who my supervisor is, posted his email, his number, found out who my HR person is, posted her name, her number, and then just like all these people saying, they're trying to drive me out of town. So anyone who advocates for homeless people, they try to drive them out of town. Go back to Sacramento. Go back where you came from. You're not welcome here. And intensely violent things. They've been following us around town, videoing us. It's just like, it's wild.
Yeah, I saw somebody videotaping yesterday.
He's one of them.
Right. So I really appreciate that you rent U-Hauls and help people. There aren't enough trucks. There aren't places to take people. It is the most desperate thing I've ever been part of in my life. I hope the listeners will get involved. There are a number of groups. They're not as feisty as Kelly, perhaps, but they are good groups. They're trying to provide food. You know, right now, on top of everything else, the Jesus Center is no longer providing food, and the City Plaza, which is the only bathroom downtown, has now got a huge fence around it. Anyway, the groups are Butte County Shelter for All and Stand Up for Chico. You can find out information there about how to get involved. There are people doing food, and they also, at these food things, it's a good place to meet other like-minded people. Safe Space continues. It's only working with people with medical problems, so it's only helping a handful of people. But there
you know, there's a lot of us out there who deeply care for our fellow human beings. We believe in their rights. We believe in their dignity. And we believe that they need to have a sanctioned campground, a place to park their vehicles, a while housing, which is very is critical while housing is being built. And Kelly, add to that, can you?
Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the other things that Jesus Center was offering was laundry services, showers, and also mail services. So it was really critical to have as a resource for people who are either trying to get jobs or have jobs and are trying to save up money for a place. I mean, when you're applying for jobs, you have to have an address, you have to have a place to shower, you have to, you know, be able to do your laundry. And so people, these homeless haters, they're saying, oh, get a job, like, there's all these job postings available in town. Well, first of all, the people in town don't have, there's so much animosity towards homeless people that they won't hire homeless people. And I spoke to a homeless woman who was really excited because she had just gotten a job. I had talked to her when she applied for it. I talked to her when she got it. And then she got fired from it a few days later when they realized that she was homeless. So it's really hard for people to, you know, pick themselves up out of the cycle of poverty once they're there. You know, if I was living outside, I would look brutal too. And if I walked up to an interview, I don't think I would get hired because, you know, you can't, do proper sanitation, which is essential. So, it's really hard for people out there to get out of the situation. And a lot of them, you know, are people who have disabilities. They were, you know, painters who fell off a three-story building and broke their back and no longer can do their, you know, their trade. And there's people with all sorts of injuries who are now being forced to move everything that they belong from place to place to place to place. And I thought that that it was a measure of how of being a good person that you're willing to help people who are in a situation that's worse than your own. But in this community, I've never seen people are actively trying to hurt homeless people and drive them out of town, and they think that that makes them a good person. And I've just never seen anything like it.
Yeah, I don't know what else to say about this, but I had a moment that actually was working there, and then that brain cell disappeared. So, Kelly Johnson, I really appreciate your work, and I was wondering if there is a way that people can financially help you with the lawsuits, or if another attorney is listening, or paralegal, or how do you have a place that you? I don't want you to say your phone number on the air, but is there a way for people to find you and perhaps to assist you?
Yeah, so if you can go on Facebook, Stop She Goes Crimes Against Humanity, so that's my page. And, you know, I'm doing this work pro bono, but I could use some funds for, like, the U-Haul. And, you know, I've spent a lot of my own money on expenses, so I could use help with, like, expenses and also just help with people. The problem is that, of course, there's all the people who are pretending to try to help, but really they're just trying to take homeless people to jail. So it is hard to, you know, I would love assistance, and that would be great. But I just know that, like, I come into it with a little bit of distrust where I have to find out if, you know, somebody, what their intentions are. And I strongly believe that people who refer to homeless people as transients should be inherently disqualified from volunteering for helping homeless people, because that is, like, such an offensive term. And it's ridiculous, because these people who are literally the ones who are calling the police about every single encampment, who are trying to force them to move over and over and over again, forcing them into a life of transience and then labeling them as transients and demeaning them as such. They don't want to be transients. A lot of them, some of them do. They move around from place to place to place, but most of them just want a place where they can call a home and lay down their head. You know, it's crazy to me.
Yeah, I know a lot of them have been here from way before I was, and I got here in the late 70s. Oh, I know what the thing was. People also encouraged to go to the city council meetings. We gather at 5:00. I do believe there's going to be a celebratory musical thing this time, and it's kind of
not because we have anything to celebrate, but because it's better than just crying, and it's a way to meet people and be there and show our strength and our solidarity as city council are entering the building. And then to attend those city council meetings, they are online now. You can speak on any issue, business from the floor as preferred, and also to write letters to city council. They need to know you're there and that they don't have 100% agreement with what they're doing, because they there are so many very loud people saying hateful things that they think that they have a huge body of people that they're representing. And really, I don't think the good people of Chico are really on board with what this all means. I mean, in terms of cost and everything else. I mean, if it wasn't just human rights, it would also be the cost of where so much of the city general funds are going, in terms of all the time and energy it's taking them. And the people are still here. They're just more desperate.
Oh, yeah. It's never going to. I mean, this really is showing how ridiculous this whole whack-a-mole game that they've engaged in. First of all, humans are not bulls for the city of Chico to whack. And second of all, you know, it really goes to show that they're just going to keep moving people from one place to one place to one place. And it's an infinite process. They're not going to get rid of homeless people in Chico. They might kill some of them, because one of my clients almost died at the last sweep. But they're not going to get rid of them, and they're going to keep having to pay for this over and over and over and over and over again until they come up with a real solution. And a virtual prison where people are only free for 4 out of the 24 hours of their daily lives is not adequate shelter.
Right. So thank you, Kelly Johnson. Find her on Stop Chico's Crimes Against Humanity on Facebook. And I will see you in the streets. Peace
to
you.
Thank you so much. All You're right. amazing.
Take care.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm not amazing. She is. and her partner, of course, he's wonderful too, and everyone who's been out there. I mean, it's a real labor of love. And I want to play you a song. I'm going to start crying again. I got somebody great coming up next who's going to really fire you up and give you some heart here. So here we go.
You may live alone and close your eyes. Some folks do. You may dream a dream that's twice your size all night through. When the morning comes, who's to tell your dreams to? Only you. Only love, love only, only love will do. Only love, love only, only love comes true. Nothing else, you see, there's nothing else. Only love. Love within my heart, one or two, where one love would end and one would start, I never knew. If love should come your way, you'll learn to say, I love you, I love you.
All right, love. I think it's what makes us human. And I have a very loving man on the phone with me. I'm very, very, very grateful for Keith McHenry. He is one of the founders, a co-founder of Food Not Bombs, which was started in 1980 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. At that time, they were providing food in Harvard Square and the Boston Commons, and taking food to housing projects and shelters in the area. So he's got a long history with this. He moved to San Francisco in 1988, where he started a Food Not Bombs group, and he was one of 9 volunteers arrested for sharing food and literature in Golden Gate Park in 1988. In the following years, he was arrested over 100 times for serving free food in city parks and spent over 500 nights in jail. He's faced 25 years to life in prison under the California 3 Strikes Law, but in 1995, Amnesty International and United Nations Human Rights Commission brought about his release. Thank God. Hi, Keith.
Thank you. Yeah, I celebrated the 25th year where I would have been eligible for parole. I threw myself a party. Like, wow. Yeah. I got a free 25 years out of that.
Oh, thank God. So I'm just going to read this real quick so this is done. But Food Not Bombs is an all-volunteer movement that recovers food that would otherwise be discarded and shares free vegan and vegetarian meals with the hungry in over 1,000 cities in 65 countries in protest to war, poverty, and destruction of the environment. We are not a charity, but dedicated to taking nonviolent direct action. Our movement has no headquarters or positions of leadership, and we use the process of consensus to make decisions. We also provide food and supplies to the survivors of natural disasters and people participating in occupations, strikes, marches, and other protests. Keith McHenry, the thing that we absolutely need to talk about, we need to hear about what's happening in Santa Cruz, because you all have moved the dial for unhoused people. And I don't really care where you want to start to talk about this, but I know that your city has been roiling with some of the same issues that we have in Chico, but things have gone a totally different way. So take us back to the start of the COVID outbreak, if that's a good place, or wherever you want to start this story.
Well, it might be that, we've been organizing for quite some time, so we for the rights of unhoused people here. And we did a 2-year protest where every Tuesday night our city council meets on the second and fourth Tuesdays of the month. So we did it every night, called the Freedom Sweepers. That applied a lot of pressure, but it also built us a really strong alliance between the some housed and unhoused people. And then there was eventually a new chief of police who came from Eureka, Andy Mills, and he kind of drove the homeless into an area behind a mall, which was called Ross Camp. And then there was a brutal eviction there, and some of our friends died as a direct result of that eviction and the lies of the politicians when we got a temporary restraining order from the city from the eviction. And that kind of sets the stage, because we've had a lot of distrust with the city officials, because in the case of the Ross Camp eviction, they told the federal judge in San Jose that that there would be a place for everybody, all like 150 to 200 people. It might have even been as many as 300 people who had found safety behind this mall. And similar to what the Andy Mills, the chief, had done when he first was hired up in Eureka, where he evicted a camp behind a mall, and then he sealed off an area in town and so on. So he was repeating the same pattern, and our allies in Eureka were warning us that this would be the case, and it turned out to be true. And so one of the main plaintiffs in the first TRO that we got, that was written by unhoused people, and Desiree Quintero, was killed when she was forced out of there in a tree cruster when she was trying to help some other unhoused people in the woods outside of the edge of town. And so that sets the stage. Then when COVID happens, there originally was a plan by the city in about March, maybe 20th or so, where they were going to have all the homeless people moved into what they called triage centers, which were these fenced-in parking lots all around downtown, with where they just provided a portable toilet and a pop-up tent for the city staff to sit under, and some tents for people to sleep in. But there was not any other services, and there was going to be no medical attention or anything. And we actually resisted that, saying that they wanted us to lure people into these camps, but they looked a lot like prison camps, and was pretty eerie that was an idea. So we refused to cooperate. And then as we ended up getting evicted from where we were serving food at the time, which was a town clock, and we had actually decided to do it every day when we learned that the other food programs were going to shut down because they were held indoors and it was not safe under COVID. And so then we also were trying to pressure the city. We're a tourist town. We have many, many hotels here. And right now, the people that are in these hotels, by and large, are construction workers who are busy building more hotels and luxury condominiums. So we have, I think, about 7 major luxury condominium projects and another 7 large hotel projects that are being built here. And yet we have several thousand people living outside. And so we try to pressure the city into taking the governor's money and the county, both the city and the county, to start putting people up in hotels. And it took probably over 100 days, maybe even longer, before they started actually placing the most vulnerable people in hotel rooms. And I think their count is that there's 200 people in hotels right now. But they also evicted people from all throughout town. In fact, a number of unhoused people received tickets for not sheltering in place, and their addresses would be transient or none. And so we were combating that. And so we ended up doing food every single day. We also built our own, we've had our own hand washing station for about 3 years now that were made out of stuff we got at a hardware store. And so we had the only reliable hand washing station, the only access to free drinking water, and the only access to food. And that's been the case every single day since March 14th of 2020. And there are now meals in these hotels that are being delivered, and there are meals at the city and county managed camps, of which there's 2 camps that are like that. And then there are two other shelters, and then also the vet's hall has been made kind of into a temporary shelter. And one of our friends just died there, Ricky, about a week ago, from falling down the stairs, actually, crushing his head. So that's been kind of the background of this. And there's also beyond that is the real estate industry, particularly National Association of Realtors, but a Association of Apartment Owners of California and so on, put $750,000 into a campaign, first of all, to defeat rent control, and then to run a recall campaign to get rid of the 2 city councilors that were seeking some kind of solution for the homeless. That was Drew Glover and Chris Crone. And replace it with a pro-property speculator city council. So right now we have 1 city councilor who is in support of unhoused people and human rights in the city, and the rest are essentially all out for let's get rid of the unhoused people immediately. And so we filed a temporary. So in December, it was announced they were going to do the holiday evictions of San Lorenzo Park, which is near the county building. And we were unable to block the phase 1. There was 3 phases, and we didn't have enough people out there to do it. But then on phase 2, we took the fencing that they placed to secure the area they had liberated from the unhoused, and we used that as our barricade, and we stopped them. And then we got a temporary restraining order, which then got renewed, and then it became an injunction. And that's where we are now, is we have been trying to negotiate with the city, but it's been very difficult. And on this situation, it's somewhat complex. We have a victory in that the city had to set up another camp about 100 yards away from where people are currently living in San Lorenzo Park. So from that perspective, that is a victory, because their original plan was to kick everyone into the woods and into doorways and just provide no kind of support at all. But there's some negative aspects of this settlement that we have, this agreement that we're working on, and that is it's a managed camp, probably managed by the city. It has all these egregious rules, which some are probably unconstitutional, even though the judges ordered it, them to be followed, such as you can't swear or say, you know, stuff that we wouldn't want to have happen, but, you know, to say sexist things or racist things. But you can't really have a law about that. You can't really, it's left up to interpretation by whoever's running this camp to evict people. And then if you're evicted from the camp, you can't be anywhere in that park area for 60 days. And that, I think, is also probably illegal, but the judge ruled that that was okay. And so they have all this, like, what they call a code of conduct. And I think the most egregious aspect of the whole conversation is the fact that the people that are living in San Lorenzo Park are not considered really as humans by, sadly, the federal judge doesn't quite see them as full humans, at least in her language. And I think a lot of it is because she has really no interaction with people living on the streets. And therefore, they're this abstract concept. And the city certainly talks as though the people living outside are nothing more than drug addicts, alcoholic psychos that need to be managed and can't, you know, participate in the world on their with their own agency. And that's where we are pushing back, and that's why we have the Santa Cruz Homeless Union and how Food Not Bombs is working with the homeless union to try to defend the rights of people living outside and to encourage people to have realize their own self-respect and self-worth, and I think that this injunction has done a lot to build confidence amongst the people living outside that they themselves do have rights. They're not being isolated and forced into corners of the city. So it's been very, very valuable from that perspective.
Yeah, I was really overjoyed to read about what you all had been able to accomplish. We did have Anthony Prince on KZFR on Wednesday night, but there was technical problems, so we didn't get to hear a whole lot from him about the homeless unit, homeless people's union. But how was he the attorney that did all this work with you guys in terms of injunctions and restraining orders and all this other stuff?
And on the original case in Ross Camp, he was, we picked his brain, and it was actually Alicia Kuhl and Desiree Quintero who put together the lawsuit to Desiree living in the camp. Alicia, who is the president of the Santa Cruz Homeless Union, living in her RV, and Anthony helped with that. But in this one, Anthony took the lead in all the litigation. Mm-hmm. And he's super busy. He also has been involved in litigation in Sacramento with the Sacramento Union of the Homeless. He's been joining with an effort in Pacifica against eviction or a law against people living in their RVs. And he's been most recently active in Marin County and Sausalito, where there's been an attempt to sweep a camp there. So this, we're in like kind of this intense period of history where the anti-homeless sweeps, even though it's counter to what the CDC is suggesting, and I think even the moving of people from one part of San Lorenzo Park to another, which is potentially going to happen in the next 2 weeks or so, is probably also contradictory to the policies of the CDC, even though the people will be moving a few hundred yards away from where they currently are. Still they're breaking up the camp and then reassembling it. And that probably can't be good from a perspective of transmitting COVID and so on. It's probably better if everybody just stayed in their tents where they are right now rather than disassemble and move them have much of their stuff thrown away.
Yeah, exactly. So when you were talking earlier about we did this and we did that, and what does activism look like in Santa Cruz? You actually took a police fence and you used it to your own advantage. Are people doing nonviolent direct action, and are you doing nonviolence trainings, or how are you getting that cadre of people to feel empowered to do this kind of work?
Yeah, we actually have been doing nonviolent preparations, and we had one when it looked like the most recently when it looked like the city was going to potentially arrest us for sharing food at Laurel and Front Streets, which is where we are every day from noon to four, and we've been evicted 8 times our meal during COVID, and. So we have been preparing for that. And then there has been this huge kind of development in local groups organizing around the homeless. Now, the Democratic Socialists of America, they were allies of ours even back to Ross Camp. And but now there's a whole bunch of other projects, including a group that does people sanitation, which has been helping to remove, the city likes to encourage huge amounts of garbage near camps so that it helps with their public relations to drive the unhoused out of town.
We have that here, and too. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is like a universal thing where they make sure that the trash piles up so that it... And this has been a strategy for years, sadly. I just was... reviewing articles about similar things back in 1985 in Boston, where there was the beginning of the anti-homeless repression and trying to cast people in the most ugly, inhumane, dehumanizing possible way that mm-hmm. they could. So, yeah, the letting garbage pile up is definitely an important strategy of the people in power. We also had... a lot of the other interesting thing is a lot of the on-the-ground workers in both the city and the county have become our allies during the pandemic. And I think part of that is that a lot of the leadership actually just evaporated and disappeared for whatever reasons, like the early retirement, worried that their pensions might be lost in the economic collapse that is occurring now and is likely to get much, much worse. So it's been people that weren't entrenched in their anti-homeless positions that have taken up these roles, including some unhoused city workers who, they work for Public Works Department, but don't make enough money to rent an apartment. So we have this kind of clandestine association with people on the ground, including some support of police officers who have seen us day in and day out handle the situation. And our meal is essentially a daily nonviolent direct action. And in fact, you could say that the meal is 24 hours a day nonviolent direct action, because we raised money to buy a shipping container to put our food, clothing, and serving equipment and everything in. And we just moved it into a parking lot that was essentially abandoned, but is city property. And we leave it there, and even though they threatened to remove it and they threatened to arrest us, we just continue to be there every day. And they have actually not, fortunately, come forward. We're supposed to be arrested on the 1st of March, but that clearly didn't happen. And I think because of the amount of popular support amongst just average people in the city, housed and unhoused, for what we're doing, they're a little reluctant to be as aggressive as they could be. And so in that way, the litigation has been a road to self-defense against these attacks by property speculators and their politicians. And, we know at some point that there will be some kind of change in those. First of all, I think the biggest issue is going to be that the amount of unhoused people is going to be so massive that the city and the county will have to adjust. I think the whole country will have to adjust. And sadly, the most likely thing will be even more brutal police sweeps. We saw, like, in Bellingham, Washington, when they were trying to remove a camp there, they used an armored vehicle as part of their assault with state police and city police, county police, I guess, as well. And so we see that with Echo Park. We saw, like, in L.A., where there was a massive police presence, including helicopters and so on. We saw that in Minneapolis recently. It's been brutal sweeps in Denver. There was, you know, people were injured in the sweeps in Sacramento. And it's this kind of background which is what's inspiring so many people to start their own local homeless unions. And it's just, that's just taking off. As well as Funabombs. I just got an email a few minutes ago from Buenos Aires Funabombs wanting us to update the website to have more accurate information on what their, you know, their contact information and what their plans are, what they're doing. So and right now we're also have several groups in Myanmar that are resisting the military coup, and I'm hoping that the internet will return to Myanmar by the time we have our next global Funabomb Zoom meeting, which is on Wednesday the 14th of April at 7 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. And people could email me keith@funabombs.net if they want to participate in that meeting. And the last few have been amazing. People from South Africa that do Funabombs, Sofia, Bulgaria, Czech Republic, from like India, New Zealand. It's pretty amazing having conversations with people around the world about shared issues. And the last one we had was around the arrests of Funabombs in Belarus. Had a protest where they were serving food to people that were opposed to the dictatorship in the stolen election.
Wow. Oh, it's beautiful because it's big, you know, and you have to just wrap your arms around it and just, you know that you're part of something so much bigger. But do you see that Funabombs, you know, we talk about our own capitalist country and what's happening here, and it's being so much worse because of COVID and loss of jobs and all of that. Is that, do you see that when you talk to other friends in Funabombs groups everywhere else, that it's their economies because of COVID, or, you know, why are so many people unable to access food?
Yeah, it is like a sadly a global crisis, and even in what should be relatively wealthy European countries, the I think particularly since they instituted the euro and the economic union, we can see that the economies of Europe have really crashed terribly, and pandemic has only made that more extreme. But yeah, and then the lockdowns have been hugely an issue in some places. I know when we were speaking with the activists from Malaysia, they were having a really hard time getting around. The big issue in the Philippines has been that the so-called drug war, and we actually had four people killed before the pandemic, two in the Funabombs house and Davos in the south of the Philippines. That's actually was the one of the oldest Funabombs chapters in the Philippines, and they were sadly tortured in their living room and then murdered. But the issue is that the people that there, people are moving around on bicycles and motorcycles with box lunches, and they're able to get to people. But and as is the case often with Funabombs during the pandemic, we're frequently the main source of resources to many, many people in the poorest neighborhoods and the poorest parts of communities. So the struggle has been very similar, unfortunately. So even with, like, say, universal health care in England, so whatever reason, that is not the panacea that might perceive if we got Medicare for All here in the United States. So there's definitely a basic problem with the economic and political system of exploitation that is just even driving more and more people into poverty. Universal basic income for people in European countries is certainly made it less intense than it is here in the United States or in India or in other places where there's really no social safety net. But there's still, there is a crisis globally, and it is impacting working people, and it's resulting in many, many more people becoming unhoused. I talked to the local city politicians here in a little bit in Santa Cruz. Generally, I think of them because you can't actually reach them by because I don't know if this happened in Chico, but you know they're on Zoom. If they know who you are, they don't going to take it. They're not going to let you speak during public comment. Mm-hmm. That barely even happens anyway. And it's almost like this whole insulation between the community and politicians has been to their advantage because they can just do stuff without nearly as much scrutiny.
Right. And so, no face-to-face meetings.
I just warn them. It's going to be like 100, 200 extra homeless people per month in the streets, and you can't even handle the number of people you already have living outside.
Right, right. Well, I want to thank you for your lifelong work, but also for your recent work holding it together in beautiful Santa Cruz. And we, you know, kudos to you and to all the people that are surviving and helping one another. It's a beautiful thing. And thank you for being my guest on the Peace and Justice Show today, Keith McHenry. And do you need money? Should we send you money? Not that we have any.
you could go to foodnotbombs.net.
Okay.
And also, there used to be a very active Chico Food Not Bombs, and I'd certainly be supportive of helping restart that.
Okay.
And we have a lot of Paradise Fire, campfire victims who are now homeless in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
Who came here to not be homeless after the fire and now are eating with Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs. So it's like, you know, out of one fire into another fire, basically.
Right. Well, we'll leave it on that note. I know that's a huge thing for all the people that were killed, were harmed by that fire. And so global climate change is an issue we didn't even start to talk on. And perhaps I could have you back again soon. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. All right. Okay, beautiful.
Peace to you. Bye-bye.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. That was beautiful. I'm sorry. I just I'm so taken with my guests. This is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. I hope you stay well. Enjoy the beauty. Help where you can. Jump in with both feet. We need you. And I'm going to go next to the community calendar, but just let me thank our underwriters. And please stay tuned for Playing Dead. It's a great day for listening to Playing Dead. The Peace and Social Justice Program is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service and the Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help us carry out that intent. To get involved, visit ParadiseGuilds.org, also on Facebook, and at 762-1490. We're going to go to the community calendar, but I want to remind you that tomorrow we are having a special program in memory of our dear John Dee. It will be during Two Penny Opera from 11 to 2. It's a tribute to his life and his programming and his engineering and everything good about this man. So please listen in tomorrow, 11 to 2. And let's go here now to our community calendar and hear what's going on. Take care.
Hey listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM Community Calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Veterans helping veterans grow. During the month of April, the Veterans Garden Project will give away for free to veterans and their families vegetable and flower starts for their spring gardens. There will also be many plants for sale to the public to help sustain the VGP's efforts for future events. The date for hosting this plant sale has been updated and will now be held on Saturday, April 10th and 11th. You can come support by going to 3rd and Flume Street on Saturday or on Sunday. It will be at Ag Mart, 1334 Park Avenue. Come out and support veterans this season. The Wildflower and Nature Festival is returning April 3rd, 2021. The return of the annual Wildflower and Nature Festival with COVID modifications includes appropriate booth distancing, face masks, and extra hand washing stations throughout the site. The festival is free admission and offers fun for all ages. Walk through beautiful River Bend Park while shopping handmade products from local businesses. Visit the Farmers Market Loop for fresh spring produce. And complete your visit by enjoying one-of-a-kind meal creations in the food truck alley. Kids' crafts and educational materials will be provided by local resource agencies and more.